give that shit up, you can concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Hi everybody, and welcome to a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast with me, Colm, and my co-hosts, Mossy and Paul. This is episode 2 of season 3. If it is your first time listening, I would advise to go back to the start and listen from episode 1 of season 1, as we will refer to previous shows from time to time. The show does contain film spoilers, so if you have not yet seen the film, I would advise watching first, it might help you understand a little bit better. Now for today's show, I hope you enjoy.
Today we are watching, or we are talking about Seabiscuit, the film that was inspired by a book, I suppose, which was inspired by real life, the horse Seabiscuit. And we're joined by Mossy and Paul as always. How are you lads?
How are you lads? How are you all?
How are things?
And we have Mickey McCullough with us today. So Mickey, thanks very much for coming with us.
Yeah, hi Leon, how's things?
So Mickey, give a quick brief background on yourself, because I know you've had a, you've been in lots of places, and you've probably more experienced than the rest of us put together. Give the listeners a small insight into you.
From a coaching point of view, I would have coached Rossa Camogzer, who won a Club All-Ireland, first team in Ulster. Ever won a Club All-Ireland in 2009. And then from then, I sort of would have worked with sort of the Meath team there that won that Christy Ring when they do it twice against Antrim. I would have done a wee bit with Ballyboden there over the last couple of years, and collected the cones there for Paul for a year there with Dublin.
Very good. So you've been plenty of places, and I suppose you've plenty of experience of the, I suppose, the different cultural aspects involved with GA clubs as well, that like as I said, even up in Belfast yourself, and with teams down the lower ranks, and then you got teams at the top level as well, like, so you've kind of covered all areas of it.
Yeah, you know, you just go where the money is. You just go where the hunger is. I suppose it's something that we touch on later. Like with teams, and I'm sure every coach is the same, it's just something that a club sells to you that interests you tends to lend you that way, and then you've got to face that decision yourself about how far away is it or what level is it. But generally with teams that you work with, it's that initial contact and the interest that it generates within you early on sort of kind of leads you that path.
Very good. And look, you picked the film Seabiscuit. What kind of drove you towards this?
Most of the other good ones are already gone. I remember watching Seabiscuit years ago, and thinking, it's actually just a lovely, easy to watch film. You know, it's the type of film that you watch in the bus on the way to matches. So whenever sort of that the idea came up, and when you look through the whole remit of the films that everybody's talked about, they all tend to take the same format. You know, it's all an underdog does well against the big thing and gets a win at the end through adversity. So realistically, without maybe sounding nonchalant about it, all the films nearly are the same. You know, you take Seabiscuit out and you put Rocky in, you take War Admiral out and you put Apollo Creed in. You know, it's all the same type of format of a film.
And like, I suppose, look, from a horse racing perspective, I know, Massey, you have a slight interest. I suppose you would see some of the best stories that you would get in the horse racing would be the smaller stable coming and winning one of the big ones, like, isn't it?
I think so. Like, you think of, like, the Irish horses down through the years, like the ones like Denoli and that who came from small stables that just scatter a big support basis. And they're, like, again, the underdog, like, there was a great TV documentary on there a couple of weeks ago about Dawn Run on TG Catter. And it's just like the crowds that just followed that horse, because it was unique that it was a mare and stuff. But again, as Mickey said there, like, we all love an underdog story, really, don't we?
Yeah.
And you could swap them all around. Like, most of the films we've done are about underdogs. There's never really a film about that team at the top, is there?
Oh, well, the damned United, the old Leeds United, they're at the top.
They're dirty Leeds.
Well, funny, Mossy, you're saying, I was one of the notes I actually took on it was, you know, why are these films so popular? You know, yeah. And from ourselves, I'm sure, as coaches, you know, I would have spent a bit of time on buses. One of the first things you sort of used to do was get a playlist for buses to watch films and the way to games, and every single one of them was a feel good underdog story, you know. And it sort of brings it to that, like, why are they so popular? Whenever you, and probably the reason being, there's about 25 maybe at a push of these films that are so well liked and so well known. But that's because it's such an anomaly. Because 99 games out of 100, the big team wins, or the big horse wins. So, you know, as coaches, maybe we're always looking for that one wee bit of glory that we can turn over a big team on a big day. And sort of, as I said earlier, I wonder then, is that the challenge? Is that the actual challenge of taking the wee horse and maybe getting one big day, or the small team and getting one big day? Or is the real challenge to a coach to go and have the guts to take a big team and stay at the top?
I suppose the challenge with the senior is that it's probably higher stakes, like there's more reputational, I suppose, value and damage can be done with something like that, isn't there?
Yeah, well, I mean, I even look at Desi there when he went into Dublin this year. Like, he had everything to lose and nearly nothing to gain, but still went and had, you know, and then you compare that at the minute where, like, you know, Mickey Hart's went to Louth and everybody's thinking this is great. But what actually is the biggest gamble? You know, if Louth were to win one or two games and get a bit of a run in the championship, then your stock, all coaches talk about are stock. Your stock goes up, and whereas poor old Desi loses a game or comes out the wrong side of a result, and his coaching career is there in tatters. So I definitely think that when you look at him in that way, the challenge and where you're going to challenge yourself, you know, you've got to maybe at times think, well, I'm not challenging myself unless I'm trying to get to the top and stay at the top, because you can always peep around. Sure, a wee team, and we got close, so we got within 3 points, so we got within. And sometimes in places that's actually looked on as success. Whereas I think the real hassle or the real time that you put your nuts in the line every single time you go out the door is when you take the big teams that are expected to deliver and you have to get them to deliver.
Yeah, like it's just thinking there, like if just say hypothetically Brian Cody retired 7 or 8 years ago, I think that would have been a very, very tough gig for any coach or manager to follow compared to if he decides to retire now or in a year or two's time. It's a lot easier job. The pressure probably won't be as big as you have a great team there. You need to win in All-Ireland. I'm sure there's a lot of people who'd be queuing up for that job now, but compared to 7 or 8 years ago, it might be slightly different. Like you said, Desi Farrell there was in a no-win situation there whatsoever. If he lost, it was all his fault. And if he won, sure, he's only building on Jim's team.
In fairness to Desi, he probably, like, Jesus, they were nearly as impressive this year as they have been in a couple of years, like, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a real test of management, because every manager likes to go in and put his own stamp on things. Whereas with the likes of Desi situation, he had to go in and maintain. So he had to work with what was there before and probably put his own twist on things. But that you really challenge yourself as a coach, because you're not going in and just doing, well, this is what I do. We do this pre-season, we do this, and we play. You know, you're trying to just continue on. Whenever you take over a successful team, or when you take over a team that's worked very effectively, you're generally trying to keep that trajectory going without trying to cause too many bumps in the road, which in a way is maybe alien to us as coaches, because 99 times out of 100 we'll go into a team who has recently been failing. As Mossy says, Kilkenny haven't won an All-Ireland in a couple of years, so now you're able to go in and say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to change this, I'm going to look at this. Whereas when you're going into teams that have been successful, you've got to keep that status quo.
What if Desi had gone in to Dublin the first day and said, you can throw all your medals in the bin, you've been playing a crap brand of boring Irish football for the last 5 years, and I'm going to try to change it. Do you think they would have responded to him?
I think Desi watched the damned United.
Like, look, in terms of Desi as well, Desi's after going in, and Jim to an extent built on a lot of the work Desi had done at minor and under 21 level. So there's a continuation there, and Desi's just after coming back in again at it, and he'll take it off in a different direction again. And like he did bring some new players into it straight away, and you can very much see that there are a few fellas there at the back end there into their 30s. I expect there to be big change in that setup next year in terms of personnel, but I don't expect there to be much deviation in terms of how they're going about things and how they're playing and the fact that they're winning. I think it'll continue on because of, and like I hate using that word, but that culture that is developed there, that people talk about, oh geez, you wouldn't want to be in a panel and be number 24 or not even making it at 26 or whatever. But there's an element of, you have the right fellas not making 26 and they're really pushing on there, the whole stock of everything rises again, you know.
But and then even think that just a little bit more there about how we're on about how everyone loves the underdog, and the underdog stories are the ones that good films are made on. Like, I don't think there'd be much of an interest in a film about, say, the Dublin six in a row. But there's so many probably characters, individual characters in that team that there could be possibly a brilliant film about. Like, players who had something to prove themselves who came as an underdog, like Brian Fenton not making the minor team, for example. Johnny Cooper not making the senior panel for a few years after captaining Dublin under 21s and badly wanting to get in there. Philly McMahon from where he came from. Like, there's all individual stories that have come together there and created a great, great team, rather than like sort of film just about winning everything, if you get me. So I think there's stories in every team. With same Kilkenny hurlers, like there wasn't much out of them when they were winning everything, but once they retired, like their personalities are really starting to show now. Like Tommy Welch is the best pundit and the most entertaining pundit around. JJ Delaney, fantastic pundit. Henry Shefflin's coming out with shit. You know, they're just stories that have come after the event, if you get me.
Yeah, and I suppose, look, go back in the film, then, like, I think one of the strong things, it was a slow burner to start before it got into it from a coaching perspective. But, like, I know, Paul, you said it when we were chatting beforehand, there was kind of a 10-minute burst in, and there was a lot of content. And I thought the first part of that was the building the connection about knowing, I suppose, for us knowing our people, but for the trainer in the film to actually know the horse, what the horse needed and stuff like that. And, like, we spoke about it a small bit again, and going back to the Damned United, but, like, knowing the people that you have to be able to react to the people that you're dealing with. That if you're like Mickey, when you went down to Mead, you have to react to those people slightly different from the way you were probably dealing with the girls of Rossa, let's say, when you won the All-Ireland. Like, and that's an important factor for all coaches to be able to, that when you're working with different groups, there's probably different little clicks you need to, switches you need to be flicking as you're going, isn't there?
Would you just be nearly, I always think when you're doing that, you're working off your own coaching philosophy. So everybody has their own coaching philosophy. There's no right or wrong answer to it. Yours isn't better than mine, isn't better than Paul's, etc. And it's how you then bring your philosophy to each of the tables. You know, you'll go to clubs where I have a brother-in-law actually took over a team up here, and he's like their junior football team in Fermanagh. And he's saying to me, like, you know, they don't do gym programs. They don't believe in doing any running. They just want to drink beer, you know. And, like, he'll have to try and mould that into something. And yet I can sit and talk to him at times about, you know, things that we're doing in, let's say, Bowden or something. And they'd be the two ends of the spectrum. But ultimately, everybody's always looking to get the same thing. Everybody's always looking to get the win and the result. It's just how you go about it. Some people aim for that, you know, methodical, professional approach. Others will go after it being a bonding and fun and together and unity. So, as you said yourself, it's about the coach being able to adapt and knowing what best suits the people that I'm standing in front of, and then adapting how he copes and deals and implements his philosophy that way.
Yeah, I think Mickey's right there in terms of depending on the setup you go into, you as a coach have to be a chameleon of sorts of adapting to that group of players. And yes, you have your coaching philosophy, and there's the non-negotiables there within that you're going to make sure, right, this 30% is definitely, I'm definitely bringing this, no matter if I'm in Crumlin or I'm in Dublin or wherever I am, this 30% is what I'm always bringing. But the other 70%, it could be very much dependent on the team and the environment you're actually going into, you know, that kind of way.
And how long does it take you to get to know that, Mickey? Like, obviously you'll have some sort of preconception of what a group might be like before you get in with them. But, like, how long does it take you to get to know, I suppose, the players and to know the other management team if you're not familiar with them? And, like, you know, Seabiscuit was a great, I suppose, look, it was probably something where you got the owner, the trainer, the jockey, and the horse, and they all have their own links with each other. And, like, how do you kind of be the chameleon that can fit into that? And how long does it take you to get to know and understand where you sit in the pecking order, let's say?
Well, maybe I'll answer that question with a question. How long are you
prepared? I can't do that. There's no questions being asked back.
But how long are you prepared not to be yourself?
Yeah.
You know, you really want to go into a setup and be everything that you're not. You know, if you're outgoing and you're friendly and you like the interaction with the lads, are you happy then to go into a setup where you're not allowed to talk to people and you only answer it? You know, it becomes just so you have that element of it too. Something that I've learned in the recent past, going into a setup blind where you don't know exactly what you're doing, you don't know who's doing what, you don't know the kit, is a recipe for disaster. You know, I know that I've done it myself and really didn't enjoy it. As regards the other end of it, of how long does it take, you're generally, I always think it takes maybe one good session or one big win to get that momentum going. And like, we're all the same. You know, 99% of the lads, let's say lads that you'll coach, want to play hurling, want to enjoy it, want to train hard, want to take pints when they can get a chance to do it, want to have the crack, want to have the enjoyment. So, you know, you're not, it's not as if everything is completely different. You're not leaving Meath and going to Crumlin, where all these lads and I don't want to have crack and they don't want to talk to you. You know, we're all Irish males that play the game first and foremost for enjoyment. So, I mean, if you're pitching it at that level, the other things you can add to it, as Paul says, the non-negotiables, the other things you can add to it once you get, I think momentum's a big thing. Now, I remember even back a couple of years ago, going in, taking a team and first league game coming up. And as a new management in a new team, you must win your first league game, even though everybody will sit here now and say, oh, league doesn't really matter. And, you know, but you all of a sudden go into a new team as a new management setup with new ideas, and you go out and you lose your first league game, then you're swimming up, you know, you're swimming upstream straight away. So, I mean, small things like that are probably, if you put it down, the luck. You know, you go into a good setup and you get a good win the first day out, or something goes right for you, or some lad has a great gear and responds well. So all that wee bit of luck gives you that momentum. And it's momentum, I think, takes you through eventually in the end when you get to the big games and championships and finals. If you have the momentum going, momentum's an awful hard thing to turn like.
As well, when you get that momentum, you're able to throw out a bit of humour and show exactly who you are then, and it might give you the opportunity to have a bit of a cut off someone as well, because people are that little bit more relaxed. So look, and I know it's talked about a lot, winning is important, and you have to be winning games if you want to be able to progress on some little amount. But then you could be a bit sadistic and enjoy losing games and get a bit of a sense of pleasure out of that as well, you know?
Well, funny you kind of said that even there. Winning actually nearly gives you a scope to develop as a coach, because winning, for want of a word, buys you credits. So if I've all of a sudden won three or four games in the trap, the lads start to buy into you, then you can start trying things. You know, then you can start implementing maybe a puck-out strategy that if you had to try to do 4 weeks previously, they looked at you. Or, you know, I'm going to now move Paul from corner back to corner, just have a look. And, you know, by getting them wins and on that momentum, it gives you the credits to start exploring and developing yourself as a coach.
You get more time, don't you, to develop that. If you're losing, you don't. They're starting to question you.
As well at the same time, and look, coaching is such a you could say it's an art and a science. Like, it is very much, it could be the complete opposite as well. Losing gives you the real opportunity to get learning as well, and that you may, like, I might have had an idea of something, right, this is the way of doing things, and a harsh enough defeat at a certain stage could change your outlook on that and send you down a different path and question a little bit more what you're doing and the reasons why you're doing it and why hasn't it been successful. So there's both sides of the coin, really.
Yeah, it's very interesting when you were saying it there, Mickey. I was just thinking of one team I was with a couple of years ago, and probably the best team in the competition in the first game. Training was going really well, challenge games were going really well, and just fell a few points short on the day. And all of a sudden, it was like you punctured the whole thing, you know. And they were playing teams the following week who they should have beaten, and they didn't beat. And then, like that, then it was kind of a spiral in your chasing after that. And I suppose with the GA, like, it is a short season. Like, you know, there's not too many chances to correct things over the course of the year, especially with the way it's gone and the way it's going with the championship now with going forward. Like, but one of the things you said there, you said about enjoyment, that once the players start winning, they can start enjoying it a bit themselves, the trainings.
And I think we've seen that in the film when he eventually got Seabiscuit out onto the out of the countryside. And now he was doing his hooping and hollering as he was going. But I suppose it got Seabiscuit back to what he does naturally, which is running without a target or without an end goal, just running for the love of running. And we'd see, like, I know I have a dog and the dog does the same anytime we go to the park. But for players, like, just going out playing hurling and playing football is, I suppose, we've made it very structured and very regimental the higher up they go. And do we suck the enjoyment out of it with that for the players? Like, I know we spoke before about, you know, if players are winning, they're going to be happy anyway. But, like, at the end of the year, there's only been one team win. And are we sucking the life out of it for everybody else if we're putting in such a structure that's, as I said, regimental, and it's gone away from why they actually started playing hurling football?
Is that something you could nearly level it? Like, football's become very, very hard to watch in recent years. Not an attack on football, but it kind of has, from the fact that it becomes so structured. You know, where is the enjoyment in it? You know, like, even you see players and stuff coming out now, particularly in the weaker counties, and talking about, you know, where is the enjoyment in it? And it becomes then so much easier to opt out because, well, if I'm going to play for this county team who realistically isn't going to win the All-Ireland, but you're still going to expect me to train 3 nights a week and do 2 gym sessions and not go on the beer and not chase women and not do that, you know, then they lose all that enjoyment out of it. So, yeah, there's definitely, I remember a fella who would have helped me coach. I remember I used to be mustard in the lane, where I've seen people still do it now, where they manage every single situation in the pitch. You know, the keeper hits a puck out, hit it further, and the fella goes to catch it, and before it gets there, somebody's shouting, catch the ball. And, you know, a free taker standing over the ball, puts the ball down, and many people have heard shouting under the pitch, put it over the bar. You know, like, fuck me, lads. It's not that. I think he knew he could do that himself. So you do kind of wonder how much of these parameters we're putting in. And as this sort of elderly coach would have said to me at the time, if you're able to coach them through everything they're doing, why are you not still playing?
Mick, you said a good one, actually, at one stage there in the last 2 weeks, and I don't know if you even realise I said it. Like, if we're doing coaching on match day, we haven't prepared well enough in advance of the game. So I, and this isn't a hard and fast rule, but we shouldn't be doing a whole lot on match day. Match day for a coach should be a day when you nearly feel somewhat uncomfortable because of how redundant you actually are.
Eamon O'Shea came up to do a thing for us, Paul, when I was working for Ulster Council. Tipperary won the All-Ireland, it was 2010. So he came up in the February after, and it was this built around this whole big coaching clinic. Eamon O'Shea was coming up to deliver a coaching session with about 200 people at it. And it was in Dunloy. It ended up with the weather. It was inside Dunloy's hall. So big wall, big indoor hall. And Eamon gets the team out and he gets them standing there. And he just goes over and he leans in the wall. And everybody's sort of standing looking at him going like, what's he doing? And he just says, see the minute the ball threw in? This is how useful I am. And I always thought that stuck with me. And sort of as Paul said, to come back to that, I think now in the last year, you now have your warm-up where you can talk to players. You have a break halfway through the first half, we can talk to players. You have a half time, we can talk. And I just think we can talk too much. You know, go back to that. If I still need to tell you where to puck a ball and how to take a mat, then I should be playing myself. You know, players turn up on a game day and we think back their own times when we're playing. How many times did you actually listen or take on board something that somebody told you 5 minutes before a match? You know, I've been in setups where we have worked all week on a certain way of playing, only for somebody to be told 3 minutes before throw-in, no, we're not going to do that today. You know, and like, I just think we can put too much structure and too many parameters on the things instead of saying them, you know, the work's done on Tuesday, the work's done on Thursday. I would always talk to teams about options. You know, I'm not going to tell you what way to play. I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to tell you that if you were to do this, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen. Ultimately, your decisions are going to be based on the outcome, or the outcome of the game will be based on your decisions. But yeah, the more and more we put parameters on, you know, you can't pass here, the ball must go there. Like, it becomes actually boring for a coach, never mind a player.
And just go back there again, it's like, they're not just hearing one voice. Like, they might be hearing 3 or 4 different voices, which is ridiculous altogether. 2 or 3 different people telling different things. So I think that has to be made very clear at the start of the year, who's doing the talking, when you're talking and how you're going to say things and communicate across to your players.
But you never find, Mossy, we spend all our lives talking about we want to develop players that can think and we want to develop leaders. But sure, if we just stand the lane and tell, I mean, if I put a remote control in you and tell you to move forward, move back, mark him, deliver, like, I'm actually contradicting myself. You know, I don't imagine, and you see it with the likes of Cody, and you see it with even back, I would have followed United with Ferguson and stuff. They appear on the lane periodically, and they maybe let a burst out of them periodically. They're not managing the whole way through the game from start to finish.
Yeah, big time.
How do we, let's say, like Massey, you're talking about there now, about like there could be three or four different voices. Is that just lack of communication amongst the management team that they're actually all not aware of what they're actually, you know, like, because you go to
I think it's a lot of his ego as well, that people want to have their say. Like, there might be a selector, there might be a coach, whatever it is, and they think that, geez, I have to say something here to feel valued, or I want to be ego. I want to say, get my words in when there's no point whatsoever.
Anyone you're talking about in particular, Massey?
No, I'm talking about, I'm sure I've done it myself. I think we've all done it.
Yeah.
Is there also an element, Mossy, would you agree? It's excitement too. You know, we all get wrapped up in the game, and, you know, as much as you think to yourself, I'm not, but you get caught up in the game. It's an emotional game. You know, you can't detach yourself from it, and you can't help yourself. And but then the problem comes when, even if you're given the same instruction, three different voices can't give it the same way. I suppose it's like making love. You know, if we all did it the same girl, you know, we're all doing it differently. But at the same, we're all doing the same thing. But it's just a case, I always think of that as, I might say something with a different tone that Mossy will say, and all of a sudden you create grey areas where players are going, but sure, he told me to do this and you want me to do that. And then that's where the whole thing starts to unravel.
Yeah. And some fellas will deliver the message faster than others as well there, Mickey.
Yeah.
I think that delivery of message and who it's delivered by and the succinctness in terms of the delivery is really important. Like, I've been involved with teams, and even if I wanted to say something at times, I wouldn't say it because, no, that isn't my actual job to give that message to that particular person at that particular time. And like, the damage on match day of giving poor information and mixed messages is like it can cripple a player, because they're going, well, Paul said to do this and Mickey said to do that. What am I actually meant to do here? And then we're coaches and the manager's giving out because he's a completely different idea of what is he wants him to do.
Or he's no idea what to do.
Like, and it is something that is critical for players.
And is it something you would prepare at the start of the year and reinforce it every couple of weeks? Or would you specifically set out before a match? Match by match, each person's role.
Personally, it would be it would be an overarching. So, Colin, this is your main role during the year. Mickey, this is what you're doing. Mossy, this is what you're doing, and that would be a 90%. That's your job to do. And on a given match day, there might be a slight bit of a variation with that, talking at half time or a pre-match delivery of a message might change time depending on the circumstances and what person in the management team is best able to deliver the message. And you know what? The manager needs to be aware a lot of the time that he probably isn't the best person to deliver that message. And being able to let someone else do it is important.
We put all the importance we talk about usually is the players, and I know this is a coaching team where about the value of the coaches on the sideline and stuff like that. But like, do coaches and mentors and backroom team need to actually spend time consistently chatting about this and what our style of play is? Because like, if you're at an average training session, the coach will be on the pitch. You might have one or two of the selectors might be engaged in the training session, but another one or two people who are probably have as vocal an input as the other three, they could just be standing on the sideline, smoking a fag, watching a match over their shoulder. Like, is it important that all these people engage with, that the manager engages all these people in what their roles are continuously throughout the season?
See, a wee bit of what you've touched on there is the size of a setup. You know, a big problem comes the more and more you dilute it down. You know, so if me and Colin's going to take a team, that's one conversation. You know, the minute we go to Mossy, there's three conversations. The minute goes to Paul, we're eight conversations. You know, it swells and swells and swells. So, you know, and I've said it actually, somebody asked me in a podcast thing before, you know, I don't understand how somebody can go and take a team, and it could be a big team. It could be, like, you know, you saw Henry and Tommy Shefflin, whatever, taking Ballyhale and Club O'Irons, and there was only two or three of them. You know, and all of a sudden then they go to county and they feel that we need, you know, nine coaches, four goalkeeping coaches, 18 analysts, two physios and masseuse, and everybody then has this. And as you say, how can you not dilute the message there? You know, and I've been in situations before, sitting in meetings where people were praising a corner forward for his tackle count. You know, Jesus, corner forward, 88 tackles, we need to be thinking, we need to be praising this. Now, to be fair to that person, he was probably in his mindset thinking, this was fantastic, that tackle count high equals great work rate. But I'm sitting there from a hurling point of view thinking, well, hold on, if my corner forward had a 1-5 of them ball, he would only have three tackles, but he might have won four on the board. I would, you know, so like there has to be some format of communication that while we'll all bring something different to the table, there has to be something common that our end goal is, you know. And I think when we're going after praising corner forwards for tackle counts, is like an after cornerbacks praising them for scoring 2 points from play. You know, there has to be some form, and I do agree with Paul, that's where the manager then has to come in and set, and all that focus has to come through. How many times, you know, if one of the things in Seabiscuit, to go back to the film, was, if you remember, the two jockeys, remember he was in hospital, yeah, and the two jockeys came together and started talking about what he does and how he likes to do this and watch for this. Now, you think of that, even from a coach taking over from another coach, you know, if I'm going to go in to take the Dublin under-20s next year, well, the first thing I'm going to do is put Paul down. Sure, last year he didn't do this, and the year before he didn't do that. And, you know, he made heroes out of Westmeath and Offaly, one rope says. But instead of me doing that, would I be better off, sir, speaking to Paul? Look, I'm taking over the Dublin under-20s. 12 of these lads you had last year, what are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? And likewise, Paul possibly, of, you know, you get a coach that's just gone out, possibly thinking, well, I'm not telling him anything because I want him to feel it makes me look better. And ultimately, all we're doing is putting the players at jeopardy. You know, somebody asked earlier on about how long does it take you to build that rapport. Well, if I went and had a 20-minute or a half an hour conversation with the manager that's just left, I would get a fair grounding in what I'm going into. So if you take that and change it, instead of talking about the manager going in and out, let's talk about then the managers just within that setup. You know, there was two people who, one was taken over from the org, were able to talk. So if us four were taking Cooney Gales, you know, would we ever sit and talk about, geez, I'd like them to play this way, and I'd like them to do this, and I'd like them to do that, and hear somebody else saying, well, I wouldn't like them doing that, I would like them to do this, and actually find a common ground where the four of us are all pulling together, as opposed to wanting four separate things.
Yeah, I think we alluded to that there in the Damned United as well, about the conflict amongst between management teams. And like, look, I'm sure if we all look at our own counties, we can see that some managers, like what you said, they're kind of hoping another manager will fail so that when they get their chance, or if they get an opportunity, or so that they can get an opportunity, that, you know, they're of actual no help and it's detrimental. Like, but for clubs, it seems like an easy fix for clubs to be able to put in that community of practice where we can get the under 12, under 14, under 16, under 18, under 21 and senior coach all talking together on what, as you said, a commonality of a style of play. Because I don't think we'll ever get to a stage where a club are going, this is exactly how we're playing. Like, you know, you as a manager, Mickey, if you're being given an opportunity, right, stick to 60% of it. But if we all stick to 60% of it and our own styles vary for the last 40, like, I think you'd be on a very good thing for a club then, like, wouldn't you? For long term, like I said, I think that's probably where you'd love to get to with a club structure, wouldn't it be?
Well, isn't that what the soccer model is? Like, when you look at Ajax and you look at Barcelona and stuff, how their state of play fits into, you know, so into the end game of playing for the A team or the first team. But, I mean, from a coaching point of view, I think too many coaches then, you know, why do I want somebody to fail? I'll get that job or what? You know, I think we forget that realistically, and I think Mossy maybe alluded to it earlier, and I definitely feel that way, maybe other people don't. Coaches are absolutely irrelevant. It's the players that are playing the game that are the important people, and we've got to do what's best to them to let them maximise their potential. And if that means you need to talk to somebody to find out about something or you need to share something, so be it. But, I just think too many coaches now feel that they're the important, that they're the people are paying into the grounds to see the coaches, and ultimately it's the players that suffer.
Yeah, and like back in the film, then again as well, one of the other things that you could see it in the film was when he was, before Seabiscuit, let's say, went with the crowd he was with, he was a lead horse. He was out for training and he was building the other horse's confidence. And as I said, he was trained to lose. Like, I know, Mickey, it's something you mentioned beforehand. Like, it's something that happens with young players a small bit once they go into a more elite setup, isn't it? Or does it?
Well, that's come back. I would have worked for a number of years as a development officer. So you see the work, and I know Colin, yourself and Paul at something similar, working with young players and what you have to go to get that lad to even be a county minor. You know, the years spent at under 14 and 15 and 16 and busing them and travelling them and starting to teach them their S&C and starting to teach them what they've got to eat. And, you know, I've seen it firsthand as a player being in the County Panels. I've seen it as a coach being in County Panels, where you're bringing these 18, 19-year-old lads out and they've been excellent for their county minors. They've been good. They have a great season for their club. And you bring them in the senior setups and they're not going to, it becomes very evident very early on, right? Okay, they're not going to make the team here, but they're just kept there. So, look, yeah, we're still training Tuesday and Thursday, and you find that they're the ones being shouted at. You know, you're spilling the ball, you're not moving quick enough, you need to be working harder, you need to be doing your gym. And we're constantly just lashing them with a whip, lashing them with a whip, lashing them with a whip, because it's easier to do that than it is to pull the star man or the captain or the centre forward and tell him he's not working hard enough or he's not. And the knock on effect then is, then you're going to be in house games. And as we all know, whether we'll admit it or not, but we're guilty of it, we'll line out the in-house game and we'll put all our main men where they generally play. And Paul's sub, but he's a wing-back, so we play wing-back. And Mossy's sub, and he's just going to make the squad. But, you know, Mickey's that wee 19-year-old who's a corner forward, but sure, look, just throw him in the corner back. So he's only making up the numbers for a game. And what messes and what are we doing to them young players? And as I said, the experience that sort of even them abode in there last year, sort of two of the lads that would have been around the Dublin setup coming back to this, and there were shells of the lads that I remember 2 years previous that were just bursting onto the scene and were mad for road. And you're nearly like having to rebuild a young lad. And I just wonder, up and down the country, you see the amount of these young lads that come out of colleges and come out of universities, and then we'll lose them. We'll never see them again. You know, you're probably taking DCU or UCC and you're saying, geez, he's one for the future. And then they never ever make it through. And I often wonder, if there was a study done, how many years did they spend sitting on the bench or at the back of a bus, not in the 26 or in corner back when they're in corner forward or asked to fill water? You know, would it take real balls for a good coach and a good manager who cares about his players to say, you know what, Paul and Mossy, you aren't going to make this year. You may have a potential of in 2 or 3 years' time, away back to your club and continue to develop. Now, that might mean, for me, the coach with the ego, geez, it looks like I've lost two players or I'm now down to 28. You know, we're not doing the, I go back to my previous thing, we're not doing them players any benefit whatsoever. Mm. And unhappiness is like a cancer within a setup. You know, them two lads are unhappy because I'm not getting game time and I'm not training and I keep getting yapped at. And misery loves company. So the next thing you know, there's three of them and then there's five of them and then there's 10 of them. And the whole thing starts to unravel. You know, I just think some places and some coaches maybe need to take a brand new look at things. You know, okay, we're not making it. Me telling you you're not making it isn't failure. You know, again, you go to Seabiscuit, how many times was he told, this isn't going to happen, you're not going to do it. Just not making it in that particular day, on that particular year, isn't you failing. You know, go away, develop, find your game again, find your hunger. You know, as we talked about earlier, let him run the track free without worrying about it, and you'll see him develop over a 2, 3, 4 year period. But that would take a lot of balls from coaches and managers who probably feel that they're under pressure, that they have to get results, and they want this 35 and they want this magic number training every night so it looks good for the treasurer and the secretary signing checks. Whereas all of a sudden, if you're down 2 or 3 players, if I let 2 or 3 players go back to their clubs without realizing it, I'm actually probably improving myself for later in the year, because there's 2 or 3 lads who are going to go away and play games and get competitive games and find their mojo and find their confidence. And then if they get it, I can bring them back in again.
Yeah, I think we mentioned it before, even when you bring that back to the club level, players are coming out of minor level and they're brought straight into the senior squad and they're sitting on the bench for 3 or 4 years rather than playing like at the B team or the junior team or whatever it is, and developing and learning how to play. And it's, I think it's a big thing in GA that we're losing players just by keeping them on the sideline, just making up numbers at training sessions.
you're about 100% right. Like we've talked about this numerous times, and we talked about it earlier on in this episode of young lads want to play games. That's what they want to do. Young lads, young ones, they just want to play games. And people are involved, be it at club level, be it minor and adult, they're involved in county level, they're involved in college level. They want to be playing as much games as possible. And I think a lot of the time when managers are dealing with players that are on multiple teams, they look at them with an element of suspicion that, oh, you're involved with that team, I think you're more aligned to them than you are with us. But within the course of a year, there's different stages when the club is the most important, the county, the college, whatever it is, football, hurling, Camogie, ladies football, is they all have their period of the year where they're really, really important, right? And it's about the manager going, you know what, Mickey, I'm looking at you there now. This week, you have, if it's giving cup game on next Tuesday, I don't want to see you with us. Go out with them, get involved in that environment. And that switching between environments, be it club, county, college, whatever it is, keeps an element of freshness there for players. And they buy into managers then and are willing to do and really give hard effort when it's really required. Like this idea of training all year round for a game is madness.
Like we would have had a fella in college back years ago in Sligo. I don't know if you said this before, but he was on senior hurling team in college, senior football team in the college, senior hurling team for his county, senior football team for his county. Obviously, his club, senior hurling and football teams as well. And he I don't know how much of it he did, but he trained hardly ever. But what he'd do is he'd tell the hurling fella in our college, he was training with the football fella in the county, and he'd tell the football fella in the county he was training with the football fella in the college, and he'd tell the football fella in the college he was training with the hurling county. And all he did was just play matches. And he's still playing now, probably 15 years later, at the top level. Like, and you just go, like, he obviously had to wear about himself to know, I'm not going fucking jacking in that and that just to play with the marquee team, because there was a marquee team that he could have played with.
Can we play like 20 questions to see who he is?
No, I'd say you're probably getting about 3, Mossy. Because it wasn't too many jewel stars up in Sligo.
I'm going to guess who it is. I won't say who it is.
But it was you know, enough said, Mossy. But he would have played, like, as I said, with Sligo IT hurlers, which, and the Sigerson at the time were winning the Sigerson. But he just wanted to play, and he loved playing, and he made that decision. But you can be damn sure that a lot of managers would have pressured other players and said, well, if you're going to be at that stuff, don't bother coming back to us. And I think it's one of the more criminal aspects of the GAA is that managers can dictate what a young fella can or can't play like.
It's a numbers game, Colm, too. Like, I mean, particularly around this time of year, and you've seen it over the last number of years, I never ever understood. I think within coaches or managers, we become very possessive. You're my player. You know, we forget about the player in this, you know, and I just sort of wrote down numbers. Just, you know, if I have a panel of 30 and we're going to play a challenge game this weekend, that's pre-season and we're back in that time, or a league game, and I have 4 lads in the panel who play fits, and I have another 3 who's playing the colleges, and another 4 who play county under 21s. You know, the likelihood is, if we're honest, most managers are telling, no, you're here, no, you're here, no, you're here. And all of a sudden, we're bringing 30 lads to a match, and we can only play 20. Instead of having the brains of saying, right, you 4 go and play your fits, you 3 go and play your college, you 4 go and play 21s, I'm now left with 19, I can use up. And all of a sudden, your whole 30 gets used and playing at the weekends. One of the things that I would introduce in a couple of teams as with is the timelines of minutes. And sort of the reasoning behind that is, you think when you get to the business end of your year, you get to your championship game and you're 2 or 3 points down and you're thinking, right, now we need to go to the bench. Right, get Colm out and warmed up. Now, if you've spent 8 league games that year and Colm got 10 minutes in 4 of them and 5 minutes in an hour or 2, Colm has played 60 minutes that year, and you're looking to come on now in a championship game and change your whole year. You know, what happens if that had been the lad you said, you know what, don't want to see you this week, go you and play fits, need three fits games, and go and play under 21. And all of a sudden, you're actually bringing players in who have played 300, 400 minutes. They're well game seasoned, and they're able to come in and make a difference. You know, it's worth, again, I go back to a team in recent history where we were bringing on lads who hadn't even reached 100 minutes of competitive game time into the white heat of championship battle. And then afterwards, we're sitting going, I brought him on and he didn't really do anything. You know, Paul, you'll agree, we had a chat conversation before about our subs really had no impact. But sure, if your subs are only getting 4 and 5 minutes each week and then you're asking to play in championship game. So I'm going to take Paul off, who's played 6 league games, 60 minutes each league game, 360 minutes worth of games. And I'm going to replace him with Mossy, who has played 70 minutes and expect Mossy to make a difference. You know, I think we've lost that concept. Whereas, you know, we would have looked in some teams that by the time we get the championship, we would have liked everybody who's going to play a role to have somewhere around the same minutes. You know, so at least you have that baseline, you have the game experience under you from that year, whether it's now that game could be league games, it could be challenge games, it could be county games, but you need to play games to improve. Whereas, you know, so many teams have a lad there sitting there and he gets 10 minutes here, and yet come championship, we're throwing them out there and then wondering why they're not making a difference.
And how do you control that, Mickey? Do you have to say you have a player with your county and do you get him to log how many log he plays at his own club? Does he tell you and how much he's played at his college team? Or
well, we would have done that before, and that's exactly what we did, Mossy. We logged. So anybody that was playing anything, and we actually included football in it because it was a dual club. Anybody that was playing anything had to let, we had a nominated person, so let's say Paul, you had to let Paul know. And it wasn't the case of, I played a match. You know, how many minutes did you play? You know, I played 40 minutes, I played 35 minutes, I played 70 minutes. And it meant then that come later on in the year, you were able to see them, particularly when you were picking league games. You know, Jesus Christ, Paul's played 725 minutes. Colm's only played, right, we'll play Colm this week. You know, and it was just all about getting games. And the two ends to it, the two ends of it was, let's say the professional end of it was, we wanted lads to come on the games and make a difference. And in order to do that, you've had to play games. And the second end of it was, as we all know, being a club player, everybody's paying their membership. It's meant to be enjoyable. Why the hell should you pay £170 or £140 membership and get half or quarter of the games that Paul or Colm get?
I think it's a great thing you've done there, Mickey. I think that our listeners would really benefit from that. And I think it'd actually be very, very scary for the people I was talking about there, the 18, 19-year-olds that come out of a minor team and go into a senior panel and look back the actual minutes they played over a 3 or 4 year period if you're just going to sit on the bench all the time.
We've that actually, I don't know what way this will go out, but I'll say it anyway. We're sort of looking at that at the minute in Bowden, where we have a couple of lads there who are maybe sort of coming to mid to late 20s, who have been in the senior panel for, let's say, 8, 9, 10 years. And when you ask them the question, how many senior championship games have you started and finished? And when the answer coming back is zero over six, going like, what? You know, we're ruining your career. You know, would you not be better going, and okay, it mightn't be great for the ego, but go and play 6 games for the Bees. Go and get a run. Go and find your enjoyment. You know, okay, it's not the razzmatazz of the A's. Nobody wants to buy a jersey and wants you to sign a jumper. But as somebody said earlier, not everybody can win. Do you want to play the game? And I think them players are the players that, from my philosophy, that I like to go after. I'm not overly keen on the lads that are happy to sit number 24 in a senior panel and sure, I'll just keep tipping away and I might get a medal at the end of the year and sure, the clubhouse will be bunged and they'll think I'm a hero. Instead, I could have played 9 games for the Bees this year and I mightn't have won anything, but I'd have played 900 minutes worth of hurling. And again, is that what we're after? So putting that in the context with the minors, we're looking at that even with some lads that are 27 and maybe thinking of saying, why not go and play a full year with the Bees? Forget about the A's. Forget about coming on for 10 minutes here, 5 minutes there, and see, you know, does that improve you? Does that build your confidence? You see Man United at the minute, all the talk is they've got their confidence back, so now they're rolling. You know, confidence is such a huge thing in our performance. You know, and if you're constantly looking over your shoulder thinking, wait, he started me today, but one mistake and I'm off. You know, or I'm brought on, I'm thinking, fuck, if I don't do well, I'm not getting on the next day. You know, we're never, ever going to be able to express ourselves. Whereas letting that lad maybe go and spend 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 games down and scoring 8 points and 9 points in lording games is confidence. You can't legislate for what will happen when he comes back into that senior setup full of confidence.
And develops their leadership as well. Because they probably, if they're stepping down a level, they have to like be the big dog then, and they have to demand more from themselves. And the note then, that's what they have to do, continue on to go on to the A team again. But it's definitely, I think it's the big thing that players and young lads missing out on. I think they're badly guided within their clubs just to say, make up the numbers in the first team.
Yeah.
Is that County Board's fault too, Paul? Would you pick up on that? I know we had an instance there where we wanted to downgrade a lad who played 8 minutes of a senior hurling game the year before, because he was a county under 21, but he wasn't allowed to be downgraded. Now, that lad was a county under 20 and stuff at the time. Are we putting him in harm? You know, we're saying to, you know, Colm, who got 8 minutes, or I'm a coach and I'm bringing Colm on, it'd be great to give him a bit of senior championship experience. So I bring him on for the last 8 minutes or 10 minutes in a game we're winning by 10 points. Now, Colm may not be in line to get any championship next year, you know, if games are tight, but yet because he got them 10 minutes, he's automatically graded senior the following year. You know, there's a year that we're doing damage to that player.
Yeah, look, you know, I think sometimes the rules that are in place for the GA are a little bit too prescriptive and doesn't allow for that situation where there was a raft of injuries in the club and a fella came on and seen a bit of action. Or equally, if in your club you have a very strong under 14 team and you've no under 13 team underneath it, and the under 13 lad isn't good enough to play under 14 and he's there sitting on the bench all the time, I think, like, and this fella isn't good at all, but he's in danger of drifting away from the sport. I think it's absolutely okay for him to play a couple of under 12 games where he's not going to stand out, but he's going to enjoy himself. And a real quick word with the opposition manager beforehand: look, come here, this fella here, he's overage, but to be honest with you, he isn't going to affect the game, but we're looking to make sure he gets a bit of game time. I think there needs to be a little bit of individuality there in some of them decisions that are made. And like, as well, Mickey, going back to what you talked about there with fellas stepping back and making judgments, we only playing a fella for 5 minutes. I think a lot of the time, and it was one thing that really stuck out for me in this film, is often we're judging people on what they can't do rather than what they can do. You know, and like, we should be looking at, right, this fella is really good at A and B. Now, he mightn't be good at the other 24 things, but can we fit him in somewhere where he gets to show off his skill sets of his high field and whatever, and one or two other things, and then it's slowly building upon the other things, and we're scaffolding upon them strengths that he has, rather than going, here, you can't move, you're not aerobic enough, we haven't got room for you.
But even just on that you're saying, Paul, I think, again, that's where I think coaches then really come into their own. And it, you know, like, if you look at Seabiscuit, the story was Seabiscuit, the film was named Seabiscuit, it was a story about Seabiscuit. But for me, anyway, it was the ability of somebody to see something in Seabiscuit, otherwise there'd never have been a story. You know, you remember the bit where he looked at the horse and there was only 15 hands, and but sure, some hands are bigger than other hands. But, you know, could he be bigger? But that fella didn't concentrate on the size or his breathing problems. He saw that wee bit of fight, you know, and like one of my favourite footballers ever, you know, go back to soccer, he was Paul Scholes, who had chronic asthma, you know, and another coach sees him in chronic asthma and judges him on chronic asthma, doesn't see the other bits and pieces in him. And even though even myself growing up playing, you know, probably I often get this, you know, people ask me, geez, you were this and you were that and it was great. But I actually didn't do anything. You know, I could never be anything else but me. Whereas it took a coach to take a chance. You know, it took a coach to spend a bit of time. It took a coach to not be afraid of somebody saying, geez, what are you doing there? So, I mean, coaches have such a role to play in society. You know, we always pigeon them just into sport. But like, it's the knock-on effects of everything else that door opens just because somebody's prepared to take a chance on you.
Yeah, and look, I think what you're saying, Mickey, as well, about the players, you know, going from the A team down to the B team, and Paul, with playing the under 13, under 12, like, communication
is just so important in how you deliver that message. Like, Mickey, if you're telling Colm Crowley, look, Colm, look, go down and play with the B team. You're just not good enough for the A's. I'll be going, well, fuck you, Mickey. But if you deliver the message correctly, say it again.
Would we not be pushing you up to the B's?
Oh, yeah. we've only got three teams in the club and I can't make the B team, the third team. So, yeah, but you know, it's how you deliver it. Like, because I think every player, like especially fellas on first teams in senior clubs and intermediate clubs, there's a small bit of there's a bit of an alpha dog about it. They want to be up there and they want to be seen to be a senior hurler. And as you said, there is some fellas that are happy to go up there, and there's some fellas on county squads that are happy to be a number 24, 25, to get the free car sponsored, to never make a proper contribution to a team's success or failure. But there is players like that. But how you deliver the message to those other fellas that really want to be there, but maybe they're just not up to it. Like, that's so, so important. Like, and I suppose that brings me back to one of the last things I would have noted in the film as well, was about getting a second chance. And you mentioned about the 18-19 year old who might be brought into a senior panel and might not get much game time, and 3 years later or 2 years later, he could be gone. And I think that's one of the biggest flaws in the GA, is that those players who are high potential 18, 19, 20 year olds, and if they do get dropped off a senior panel, very, very few ever come back in at a later stage. Even though their club career might be up to, might justify getting in there. It's a rare thing, isn't it?
Is it the case of, you've often seen in Gala hurlers, for example, they've thrown in young lads 18, 19 years of age and they don't do it, and you never see them again.
Mm.
Where if they're brought in more gradually, like maybe like say some of the Kilkenny lads, like they break through the later age group and they're there for the longer haul then.
How do we make sure now you've got a strong team, you got to the county semi-final last year, a couple of good 18-year-olds coming through, you'll need them in 3 years' time, but they're not at the races at the moment. Like, how do you manage those players for the next 3 years? Like,
you'd need to close the clubhouse in Crumlin.
It's a good clubhouse. It's a good clubhouse.
It's nice. I never knew it was there, but it's nice. Yeah.
Do you know what? Like, and we've talked about this multiple times before, and it comes back to what Mickey was saying earlier on. People need to get game time opportunity somewhere along the line, and like, as Mossy said, you can build confidence playing junior D football. You can build confidence everywhere, and just making sure that they get opportunities at different stages is important. Like, it's really simple stuff. Give them as much opportunities as you can. And my one of my best memories playing with the club is we went down and we spent the weekend in Kilkenny, and he's thinking about it now. We played a match on Saturday and we played a match on Sunday. Played a match on Saturday against Loughton's up in Freshford, and we genuinely got hammered. And the abiding, like, we got wiped out, right? I'd say there was 15, 20 points on it. But Michael Kavanagh was playing full back with them at the time. And as we were leaving, one of the lads in the club goes, "Jesus, have you got your medals on you?" Right? And the look Michael Kavanagh gave him, as if, "Cop on, you absolute clown," you know. And it raised everyone's spirits, because it was like, Jesus Christ. And then we said, like, we ended up getting chatting then or whatever, and we were talking, yeah, we're staying down at Bennett's Bridge there in a B&B for the night, and then we're playing James Stevens tomorrow. And the laughter out of the Loughton's boys that we were playing James Stevens the following day, because they were all Ireland champions at the time. Right? And we went out and we had a bite to eat in the pub. We said, you know, we're not having any more than 8 points. And that was it. No one had any more than 8 points. And we went down and we hopped into the river the following morning. And we went out, and the game against James Stevens, it was a game that stood out to me more than anything ever in my life, just because of the way we approached it and how different we were to the day before.
How'd the game go?
we lost by a point. To James. Now look here.
Maybe the fresh shirt lads gave James Stevens boys a ring and said, "You can have your 16 points tonight, lads."
Possibly. But over the course of that weekend, everyone's seeing plenty of game time. Yeah. And fellas who, I know he was one of them, who was getting absolutely scorched on the Saturday, was taken off at half time. And think about being taken off at half time and another fella coming in. And then you've a point to prove on the Saturday. So taking off a fella and giving another fella an opportunity is giving both people an opportunity down the line, if you know, to try and push on and go well at a different stage.
How beneficial do you think it would be for, say, you're talking about, say, an under 16, maybe whatever, it could be any age group, really, to be honest with you, and it's somebody who's thereabouts on the team. And when they do get a game, they're conscious that they could be taken off if they make a couple of mistakes, like Mickey was saying earlier. Like, how beneficial do you think it'll be saying, look, whatever happens today, you're playing the 60 minutes. Don't worry about making mistakes. Just give them the confidence.
I remember actually being involved in setups exactly like that, of saying, particularly young lads, you know, young lads coming through and you're saying to them, look, you're playing today, you're playing wing forward, don't be looking over your shoulder, you're playing the 60 minutes unless you're carried off, go and get on with. And you can actually see that. I even go back myself as a player. I remember, I'd nearly say we'll all smile when we hear this, because we've all either been that player or been the coach that's done it. I remember going into a county final with the club in 2004, and it was between myself and another fella to start. And it was going on all week in the in-house games. I had played one half, he had played the other, and went on and on. And he got the nod to start. And I remember being fucking delighted, because I knew, first mistake, he's off. You know, and I've also been the other end of that, where you've got the nod and you're going, oh, Jesus Christ, I'm just warming this jersey up for him. So particularly with players that are fringe players, remember, everybody knows that your core players and your key players are going to perform, your key players are going to deliver. It's your fringe players that ultimately win you the games. So if you can get them to deliver, that's the key. But if they're not confident and they're constantly looking over their shoulder and then they're never ever going to deliver. So it's fine in that way. And yeah, it comes to that young lad. And I think even with the new system now of under 17 and under 20, it's going to be even harder for that young player to bridge that gap, because they're another year less physically developed, less mature, less ready for the rigors of, you know, pretty much you've got to remember, when that 19-year-old goes in the senior dressing room, he's not much bigger than being a child going in dealing with men who don't want him to play because they want to play. So you really need to find and fall in the real right environment that nurtures you. Unless you're Conor Callaghan, who can walk in and set the world alight. You know, how many potential Conor Callaghans have failed at the wayside because they couldn't deliver in their first year? You know, you bring that young lad in who's played very, very well for the minors and scores. You know, we're bringing a lad in. He scored 14 points for the minors last year. But sure, he's not going to do that. Arsenal, all of a sudden, there's a line through his name. He doesn't get on the squad the next time. And by the end of the year, as you maybe alluded to, Colin, he's never coming back in there. Now, there's two ends of that. He's never coming back in because that manager will maybe stay on for a 2 or 3 year period. He saw enough that day and he's never going to look at him again. And the other bit that we neglect here is that kid's 19. He still doesn't know what downstairs is for, probably. He still doesn't know what he's wanting to do in life. He's still awkward, standing in front of... and yet, we've actually now just discarded him in what is probably, like, all of us that play the game, it's our dream to play under county. So his dreams have been shattered. You know, he doesn't know what, and through that emotional end of things, we're ruining young players.
Yeah.
And Mickey, there's also the element of they're stopping living their life for it. And, like, they're missing out on X, Y, and Z, other things they can be doing. And that's why they do eventually just knock it on the head, you know, and go in whatever direction it is. Like,
they're sacrificing a lot.
Well, but most, if me and you come out as two lads at minor, and I'm the star minor player, and you were just an average enough one, so that shouldn't be too hard for you to imagine, right?
I hear no. Mossy was elite.
So I make a county panel. So straight away, I'm the big dog. You're maybe slightly jealous at that stage. I'm balls like space hoppers. I'm a county man. I'm heading the county training on Tuesday. Now, fast forward 2 months down the lane, I'm not making the county team anymore. Sitting on the bench, willing to get water, not getting you know, any enjoyment out of the game. You might just have decided 2 months previous, I'm just going to play a bit of club. You've played 4 or 5 league games. You've been out with your mates every Saturday. You've your holiday booked to Ibiza. You know, who's actually enjoying it more? And then it comes back to philosophy. I always think a successful team is an enjoyable team. You know, if you're all of a sudden enjoying it much more than I am, I'm never going to turn that around unless I get that break and get away from it. Whereas you, who was initially seen as the weaker part of this, has actually become the stronger part.
Anything else on the show that we haven't touched on that you want to chat about, lads?
I thought the owner was punching above his weight when he pulled your woman. I thought she was far.
Yeah, but Mickey, it's all about
the coin. That's why.
All about the coin.
But she was also one of Colman's favourites. She was actually in one of Colman's favourite films.
was she in Fake Taxi?
No. Pitch Perfect 1, 2, and 3. I think they're...
I don't know if she wrote them or she produced them or what, but she had an input in them anyway, yeah. But
Do you know what I really enjoyed actually was, you know, when and it was mentioned already, that hospital scene where they were talking, so Red was talking to the new jockey and saying, yeah, and you know what? Just pull him back a little bit in the last 10 minutes. Just so we get the fight out of him in the last 10. Like that ability to change strategies mid-game is something that's important, and getting the other team to react to a strategy is something that's important, and can be the winning and losing of the game, because we'll say the management team on the sideline are trying to figure out, well, what are we going to do about this now, and they haven't got the answers, and it can just can create a great panic and chaos, you know.
But I remember having this conversation with you, Paul, about that before, where you know, you went and you play a first half and you play a fantastic first half, and you go into the dressing room at half time and all you hear is keep doing what you're doing. But sure, you've given the opposition 30 minutes to see what you're doing, 15 minutes to work out what you're doing and put together a plan to stop what you're doing. So in a sense, by going out and doing the same thing as you were doing, you're actually playing into their hands. Whereas Paul's saying, if you're able to then maybe win at half time and say, right, that's working for us. But see, for the next 10 minutes, we're going to do this. You know, we're going to, you know, as coaches, one of the things, I've done a couple of coaching workshops over the time, and one of the things we would always challenge coaches is, at half time, can you think what the opposition's going to do? You know, we all get obsessed with ourselves and what we're going to do, but it wouldn't be bad to have somebody in every setup to sit back and watch your match or watch from an opposition's eyes and say, right, here's what you're doing well. If I was the opposition, I would be doing this, this, and this to stop you. And it makes you then aware, right, well, I need to maybe think of it. And you know, and Paul's thing there is that ability then to change and just give it something different. I actually thought, what you were going to point as well was, if you think about it, and I go back to an earlier statement about the players or everything, in the biggest race of the time, and the biggest race in the film, it wasn't Red rode the horse. It was somebody else. You know, so while we're maybe seeing ourselves from the jockey point of view as a coach, the players are so important. The players are ultimately the ones that will perform, the ones that will get over the line, the ones that will do the hard work. You know, it's just our job to guide them. You know, and I thought that was a great point in the game or in the film with the changed over. The horse is the important bit. The players are the important bit. We can't get carried away with our own importance.
Yeah, I think that's a good enough point to leave it at. Are we rating any of the which one is the? Are we rating someone, or are we just saying they all did a good job?
Well, Tom Smith, the trainer, and like he spotted the talent. He of a broken down horse
and jockey.
He trained it. He was able to please the owner. He was able to keep everybody happy. He was able to develop a serious talent, and like. He was like an ideal coach, if you get me. If you're going to put into a coaching thing, I thought he was a brilliant, brilliant coach.
Okay, what do you give him out of 5, so much?
I'm going to give him a 4.99 because there is a line in the film that says nobody's perfect.
Just to back even Mossy up now a wee bit, I forgot about the thing that I loved about Tom was the fact he was prepared to quit. You know, he wasn't getting to do it the way he wanted to do it. He saw that, you know, and many, you know, we see these teams, we've been involved in these teams. It was actually a point that I wrote down to make. You know, what is real success? You know, you go back to the Alex Ferguson situation. How do you be number one? You be number one by preparing as if you're number two. you know, when you see these teams, I can imagine if you went into the Dublin football dressing room or the Limerick hurling dressing room, that them lads would be pushing each other on. There would be, you know, you might know who has a car or who gets all, they're constantly fighting with each other to improve and to be better. Whereas, you know, we can get lost very easily in the trappings of things. You know, we can get lost in our media column, or we can get lost in our company car or club car, or, you know, our sponsored food. And all of a sudden you're actually not, and I think that was what Tom was worried about, that they were getting lost in the PR and lost in all the other stuff outside from actually going and delivering. And he was prepared as a coach to go and say, if this is the way you're going, I'm out. And I thought that was, it was a brilliant from his own point of view, that he was so strong in his own philosophy and his beliefs, he was prepared to walk away.
Very good. What are you giving him out of fives off?
I'm going to give him 4.98.
Paul?
Yeah. You know, I'll give him a solid 4. And I enjoyed the fact that the scene where he was looking at the wildness of Seabiscuit and then the wildness of Red, just that scene, and like most people be going, geez, I'm having none of that. But he just loved the fact that, you know what, there's a bit there that I can, them two will hop off each other and go well, you know.
Have you come across that in training sessions where somebody is does something that you see, it might be something wild, might be pulling a stroke, it might be pulling someone down or catching a ball outrageously, and say, that person can do a job for me in certain, just like what he's seen Red do. Have you come across that?
Where the heck, it'd be funny, when we had a situation in 2010, I was taking the Antrim Camogues, and I had 3 goalkeepers, right? And one who could puck a ball, and one who could see a ball, and one who could catch a ball. But we couldn't do all 3 together. And I managed to get through the whole year, and a fellow Roland McWilliams was with me, and all year we're going, right, we're going to play Colin today, and Colin will make a great catch and then let 6 in after, and you're going, no, right, change it next day. And this went on all year, and we had a girl who played fullback for the county for a number of years, but she wasn't really making the team now at this stage. She was slightly older, carrying a bit of an injury. We played a challenge game or a friendly game, and she played fullback, and she made a couple of good catches, and, you know, she strike. And I remember just that rang with me. I never said the running then. I remember thinking, geez, I had to convince myself, geez, I wonder could she do nets. But I never said it. We went on. I think we maybe played the second round of Ulster or the All Ireland series, and again conceding 2 or 3 goals, got to the All Ireland semi final, and went with a girl for the All Ireland semi final, and we were playing down, and we played down maybe 4 or 5 weeks previously in an Ulster thing and beat them by maybe 30 points. And they threw the ball in at the start, and somebody picked it and hit it for down. And the ball sailed 60 yards. As soon as they left their hurling, knew where it was going, straight over the goalkeeper's head, straight into the net. And we very, very nearly didn't recover from it. You know, we ended up only winning by a point. And I remember racking my head. And we had 36 girls in the panel, and Antrim had struggled for years even to get 22 or 23. With 36, all training well, with 3 goalkeepers fighting it out for the position, I could only name 30 players in the panel for the All Ireland final. I dropped all 3 keepers and played the fullback, and she got man in. And I remember even thinking, I was nuts and going, I got it. You know, it was, now if it had a backfire, I mean, there, but geez, she was brilliant.
Brilliant.
So there you go. I suppose, look, you know, it is an important thing for youth coaches like this. You know, it was a fella in Mars said it to me years ago when you're kind of starting to come out there. He said, put her in goals. And I said, no, she's too good outfield. And he goes, it's like this. Will she score 5 goals? And I said, no, she might get 2 or 3. And he goes, she'll save 5, put her in goals. And in fairness, like I said, for underage, it is something that's important. I'm going to give him a 4.5. Mickey, thanks very much for your time, man. Really.
Question for Mickey there. Just we're just talking about clubs there and whatever. How did you feel and how did you get over and how did you get around? You said you were looking after a me team that played Antrim in Christy Ring finals.
I have a checkered history there. So I actually took Derry in 2008 and 2009, and we won 2 Ulster under 21s, played Antrim both times in the final, and then took down Miners 2012, I think it was, and again beat Antrim in a final. And then me, it's awful. There's no other way to describe it. It's awful. You've got to detach yourself from it. It's kind of helpful maybe when the people that are taking Antrim you wouldn't be too keen on, so you don't get that away a bit. But you know, you're going out there, like you're going out onto the pitch afterwards to shake lads who's your own club mates and your own, you know, and in different circumstances or in right circumstances, I would support Antrim, you know, every day of the week. It's your own county and it's done a lot for you. But I think then when you're brought in to do a job for somewhere, you've just got to do that job. That's what you're there to do that day. Like,
yeah, very good.
Brilliant. Good stuff. We'll leave it at that. Thanks, lads. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, lads. Bye. Thanks, Mickey.
All the best. Good luck. Cheerio.
Thanks for joining us today. Please leave a review on your favorite platform, and if you enjoyed it, tell a friend. You may also want to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Roy Orbison Tattoo, and we appreciate any likes, retweets, and comments. Next week, we will be watching Marooned, Paddy O'Shea and Westmead 2004, and we'll have the show available first thing Tuesday morning as always. You can get it on YouTube, or if you Google Marooned Paddy O'Shea.